Spending time in studio with violinist Rachel Barden-Pine, whose latest recording is of the Dvorak and the Khachaturian Violin Concerti. Congratulations on the new release, Rachel. So good to have the chance to talk with you again.
Great to be here.
You say in the promo notes for this, these are two concertos that I know so well and have lived with for a long time. Why was then this the time that it all came together to present as your latest recording?
Actually, the truth of the matter is that I had a totally different album project in mind, which I still plan to make, hopefully in the next couple of years. But the conductor had a conflict at the last moment, and I really want to do this project with that conductor. So I had the studio, the orchestra, the producer, everything ready to go. And so I thought, well, you know what, I'll just do a different project and, you know, retain the dates and put it to good use. So I had to think to myself, okay, what different concertos do I want to record? And I had actually, the Dvorak and Khachaturian, as you said, are ones that I've performed quite frequently all through the years. And I happen to have played both 2 seasons ago. And I thought, oh, wait, these really do kind of go together because they're both inspired by, you know, kind of Eastern European folk music. And it really felt like the time to do it because they're both favorites. And I just thought it would make a fun pairing. So, yeah, so last minute I swapped repertoire and grabbed a new conductor. The wonderful conductor Teddy Abrams was available. And yeah, and so it was just one of those kind of spontaneous things that ended up being really exciting.
Well, changing conductors then, but you mentioned you had studio and orchestra. So the Royal Scottish National Orchestra that joins you on this recording, they were already set to work on the other project and shifted gears to go in the direction of Dvorak and Khachaturian this time?
Exactly.
to have plenty of sheet music on hand just in case we decide to do something in a little bit of a different vein, I guess. It says here that you also learned them as early as age 15, and I'm not pointing fingers. I would be the last one to point fingers at anyone's age, but how do you feel your approach to or your affinity for Dvorak and Khachaturian from age 15, Rachel, to present day Rachel? How has the music spoken to you in a different way over the passage of time?
Yeah, when you're a public performer, your age is right there on Wikipedia and there's not a thing you can do about it. So, but in any case, 30 years later, it's kind of amazing to feel, well, you know, both of these pieces are so viscerally appealing. You know, the orchestration of the Dvorak is so lush and it's so vibrant in the Khachaturian with all of these crashing cymbals and you know, wonderful snaky clarinet lines. And, you know, even though they're so super familiar at this point, just every time I hear the orchestra, especially live on stage in performance, you know, I'm blown away all over again. I feel like they can never grow old, and that's true with all of the great concertos. But definitely, each time I've returned to them, I found more and more nuances and, you know, slightly different ideas about timings and little fingerings with slides and colors that I can bring to the concerto. So it's a question of, you know, still having, I think, that first excitement of, you know, discovering them and just that they still appeal to me in that way of, wow, this is a cool melody, this is a great, exciting moment. But then also, of course, knowing them on such an intimate level and just, you know, having explored all of the subtleties over the years.
We're speaking with Rachel Barden-Pine. She is joining us from Chicago today, and her latest recording is with the Dvorak and Khachaturian Violin Concertos with the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, led by Teddy Abrams. Rachel, earlier you made the connection between the two, obviously rooted in the folk music of both of these composers. Is there something that to a casual listener or even someone who is more acquainted with this music that has touched you in a certain way about the similarities in the roots and the passions of the folk music for both composers, or for that matter, something that is very distinct to the two cultures from which they came?
Yeah, well, you know, so much classical music has drawn upon the traditional music of its time and place. And then, of course, a lot hasn't. There's no real folk music in the Beethoven Violin Concerto, for example. But, you know, these pieces have these wonderful rhythmic elements that definitely come from, you know, the music of the people, so to speak, and that, and then, you know, elevated to high art, if you will. So it's really a wonderful blend of, you know, this very appealing music that's just, you know, kind of coming from our everyday life experience, and then also this wonderful, you know, formal presentation of it. And, you know, especially in the Cacciatorian, he does such a great job of capturing not only the rhythms and melodies, but also the kind of sounds, you know, using the instruments of the Western orchestra to really imitate a lot of folk music types of timbres. And, you know, I think, well, for those of us who didn't grow up in the Caucasus, I think that, you know, a lot of this, we might even term it exotic sounding, but obviously if that's what you were living with, it wouldn't sound exotic at all. It would be your normal everyday music, and maybe the Chicago blues would sound exotic, but it definitely has a very distinctive color to it, which is fun. And I mean, it's the greatest of the Armenian violin concertos.
I like the fact that you mentioned the prior recording, the work on the blues that we talked about earlier, and I think it's kind of almost maybe it's a coincidence that can work in your favor as you travel and perhaps are having the chance now to work these pieces into some of your concert appearances while still wanting to feature music from the blues recording. Is there a way that you can reach out to an audience or to young people that you have the opportunity so often to work with that can get at some of that folk music, the roots of what it is? Because now you have these two pieces so rooted in folk music coming on the heels of the recording of the blues that it would seem almost like it presents a wonderful opportunity to kind of share both at the same time.
Well, absolutely. And I think that's, you know, one of the reasons it is so important to have classical in our lives is that classical connects people and helps us learn about each other. And, you know, in the wider music world, of course, there's this concept of cultural appropriation, and one has to be careful about such things, especially in the creation of music. But when it comes to the performance of music written by others, it's actually our responsibility as classical musicians to play all the good stuff by everybody who wrote it and not limit ourselves to some narrow slice. And so therefore, I mean, I'm not Russian and I play the Tchaikovsky concerto, right? And it's really fun to show how classical music can relate to music that you might already know and love. And I, in recent years, have actually had pieces written for me, classical concert music, inspired by heavy metal, and classical concert music inspired by hip hop. And it's just amazing to see how this music is, you know, kind of joined together and transformed. And then, of course, bringing music from around the world and throughout the centuries, it just shows us, you know, the range of human emotions and human expression. And I think it's so important, especially for young people, to understand that, you know, we're all part of the same human family and that the music can really help with that.
Has it changed your approach or your itinerary with concertizing to have, as you said, the projects somewhat now out of order, but the other one on hold and now this one coming in, but obviously concerts are booked far in advance. So how are you incorporating then, if you're having the opportunity to either the Dvorak or the Kachaturian or both, to any of the concert stops since this recording came out now as opposed to some other time?
Well, that's a great question, and logically, you'd think that there would be some, you know, sort of, you know, unified approach. But and in much of the music world, the non-classical world, certainly, you know, you make an album and then you tour that album, and you know, that's how it should be. But in classical, it's really very different. When an orchestra invites me, you know, they're thinking about what concertos have others played over the last 5 years, what else is going on our season, what else is on that night's concert program. So they don't really care that I recently recorded this concerto or that concerto. If they want the Mendelssohn, they want the Mendelssohn. And that's what's going to work for them, and that's what I'm happy to play. So there actually is very little connection between what you play in concert and what you might have just played on album. But certainly I can slip things in here and there, whether it's radio appearances, school visits, certainly encores at the ends of concertos where I can, you know, play you know, maybe one of my blues pieces, regardless of what the concerto just was. So I do try to use every opportunity I can. It's not just about promoting the album, but more importantly, it's about promoting the repertoire project, which the album is highlighting, and getting some of that repertoire out there, which is really the whole point of the thing. So yeah, that's just sort of how it works.
But yeah. it can't hurt to have a shameless plug for the record, though.
Oh, no, I mean, why not?
By the way, this happens to, this nice encore that you just heard happens to be on my latest recording, and you can find it at dot, dot, dot. So you also mentioned, of course, the continuing work to commission new works, and maybe you want to talk some or not about the project that was put on hold, but are there other things that are involving any other commissioned or modern works that are right now, for lack of a better term, in the works for Rachel Barton Pine?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, gosh, when it comes to CD projects, I've got, you know, dozens of ideas that I hope to get in the can, you know, in my lifetime. I'll certainly never be bored, that's for sure. But actually, in terms of new pieces being written for me, I'm very excited about the Los Angeles-based composer Billy Childs, who wrote a violin and piano work that appears on my Blues Dialogues album, and also wrote an unaccompanied suite for me that I've been performing quite often alongside some Bach. He's writing a violin concerto for me that's going to be premiered in Millennium Park here in Chicago with the Grant Park Orchestra this summer, and then I'm taking it around the country with a variety of orchestras next season. And I don't know what the concerto sounds like yet, but having worked with Billy twice before and just love his music and his writing for violin, I'm very, very excited about what this concerto is going to turn out to be. And as I was writing the liner notes for my Dvorak and Khachaturian record, I was thinking once again about this, you know, the wonderful stories of the collaborations between violinist and composer. In Khachaturian's case, he wrote it for David Oistrakh, and Oistrakh loved it from the get-go and was super excited about it. And, you know, Khachaturian wrote it in 3 months, just, you know, knocked it right out, and Oistrakh started performing it right away, and everything was just super happy. And then Dvorak and Joachim was almost the polar opposite. Joachim was, you know, he had played some of Dvorak's chamber music and liked Dvorak as a composer, but Dvorak had radical ideas about formal structure for his concerto. The first movement is not sonata allegro form. It's really free-flowing and, you know, stream of consciousness, tone poem style. And Joachim just couldn't wrap his mind around that. It just seemed wishy-washy to him. And even though it was chock full of great melodies and exciting rhythmic elements and all of that, he just didn't accept that there was no recapitulation and that it didn't, you know, the first movement doesn't end and then the second movement starts, but they kind of like meld one into the next. And yeah, Joachim just could not deal with that. So he had Dvorak make revision after revision over a period of years and finally just refused to play the piece in the end. And, you know, luckily Dvorak found another soloist to take it up, and it was successful and everything was great. And they could tell Joachim, I told you so, this is a good piece, even if you don't think it is, the public likes it. But it's really interesting to think that, you know, while Joachim did so much to elevate the musical taste of Europe and was one of the finest musicians of his day, he certainly was not infallible, because his rejection of the Dvorak concerto, I think now when we look back, we think that that's just pretty ridiculous. And so I do not plan to reject the concerto that's being written for me, that's for sure. I'm looking forward to the collaboration, and it's fun to think that, you know, 200 years from now, somebody else might be reading about the back and forth between Rachel Barton Pine and Billy Childs and studying about the origins of that concerto, which at the moment doesn't even quite exist yet.
It sounds like it'll be a collaboration much closer to that of Khachaturian and Oistrakh, though, which will probably make it a much more smooth sailing process. Right now, the recording of the Khachaturian and the Dvorak that is on this latest recording with you and the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, led by Teddy Abrams. We'll look forward to that Billy Childs project and much more ahead for you, Rachel Barton Pine. And thank you so much for taking the time, Rachel Barton Pine, to talk with us today. It's, as always, been a wonderful delight, and all the best with the new recording.
Thank you so much.